You're listening to Gilder 4 Radio, broadcasting live across the swamp, the hive, outlands, and the far reaches of the athlete.
Well, hello again, everyone. Has it been a month already? Well, no. But thanks again for tuning in. Elle from the Dome Runners reached out to us and invited us onto her show, and this is the resulting interview. She wanted to focus on the Ash Waste and specifically the Nomads. Originally, we were intending this to be included with episode 6 of Gildersford Radio, but unforeseen technical issues meant it had to come later and separately. This interview was recorded by Elle as a video call for the Dome Runners, but we wanted to share it ourselves. It was going to be the whole GFR team, but Lawrence and Roscoe were unavailable, so it's myself, Lee, Dixie and Gaz, along with Elle. Anything to add, Dixie and Gaz?
Oh, it's just good fun to have a chat about the Nomads and what they're all about and what they can and can't do. But also just great to have that that engagement from other Necromunda podcasts, really. So long may it continue.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to second that. Like, I've been listening to Dome Runners probably for the last couple of years on and off. So to be invited on to actually speak about something like I actually know a little bit about it was A, false, and B, really fun for me. hopefully somebody learns from our lessons that we've picked up along the way and can kind of hit the ground running a bit sooner with a gang that's probably not immediately apparent how to get the best out of them. That's what I hope for.
Well, without further ado, let's get into it.
So joining me is some of the crew from Gildersford Radio, and we are going to talk Ash Waste Nomads. So starting off, you guys want to introduce yourselves. Dixie.
Yeah, hi, Dixie, head arbitrator at Gildersford.
And Lee?
Lee, old guy from Gildersford, played Necromunda since it came out way back in back in the last millennium.
And Gaz?
Yeah, I'm the local village idiot and the, probably the most enthusiastic newcomer.
All right, so Ash Waste Nomads. I'm going to lift the curtain a little bit and say that we already started the recording this and we're kind of redoing it because of some issues on my end. So we may speed through some stuff that took us a little while to kind of formulate the first time around. So starting off with Ash Waste Nomads, what draws you to Ash Waste Nomads? Dixie, we'll start with you.
So for me, this is the first opportunity we've had really to go outside of the setting of Gildersford, which we've our club's been playing in for nearly 20 years. So they are, the iconic outsider, literally. So I find them fascinating because they're other than the Ratskin gang back in the original Necromunda, it's the first time we've had something very different to the house gangs and associated other gangs that are inside the hive. So I found them really interesting from that perspective.
Lee, how about you?
Pretty much the same as Dixie. I mean, I played original OG Necromunda, and as soon as the Outlands came out, I fell in love, and I've been in the Outlanders right from the get-go. The Redemption, the Spirers, the Ratskins, and I've got all those gangs. The Redemption is my go-to. But yeah, I mean, I wanted to play something a bit different, and so I think I'm the only one that's actually played them in one of our campaigns. I struggled with them, and we've sort of talked a little bit about that, and we'll get into that in a bit more. But yeah, I love the very different narrative, and they in bringing their very difference, they present a bunch of quite unique challenges, of which I will be honest and say I have not mastered at all.
And Gaz, how about you?
I'm just really drawn to the models. I'm a big fan of Dune, and I recently watched the new Boba Fett Book of Boba Fett series, and I really liked the way the Tusken Raiders were, depicted as these, struggling survivors out in the desert. And I've always been interested in the bit of lore, that's even in the Necromunda General Rulebook about the previous, occupants of the planet being pushed out of the hives out into the wastes and sort of defying Imperial authority. And even houses like House Aranthus, the rumors of survivors escaping out into the desert and maybe being subsumed into these nomad tribes. I kind of like that aspect as well. you know, rising back up and trying to take back the planet, but biding their time. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, I think that the nomads represent something that is, you know, the other houses, a lot of detail has been filled in. A lot of their history and timeline has sort of been added. And of course, it's all handled in this sort of in-universe history way where it's like, is this true or is this myth that's become considered reality? But with the nomads, we don't have anything equivalent to that. They are a very mysterious institution on Necromunda, and it remains that way even after the release of Book of the Outlands and all of their stuff. We really don't know that much about them. We know some of their like religious practices and what with things they worship, but we really don't know much about what their culture and society looks like. We don't even know what they look like.
I feel like they could be tied to the Iron Lords, you know. I'm wondering whether that will play out as more Aranthian succession books come out, you know.
Yeah, I'm very excited.
I do wonder whether House Aranthus and Aranthian succession are, you know, that doesn't seem like a naming mistake to me.
So yeah, I had that same thought. I don't think we're going to get anything at Adepticon.
No, I know. I'm wishing.
I don't know what's going on with that, because like it's been 4 months since they showed the Dune Walkers, and I'm playing Cawdor in an Ash Waste campaign. I'm like, guys.
Yeah, well, me too. I'm about to do something. So yeah.
Yeah, I like that they went in with the narrative side and they didn't reveal really anything. Like, there's, you know, even as the narrative is written in the books, as you say, kind of an in history, you know, an in narrative perspective, it's like, you know, yeah, we don't know. They're outside and we can't even find a corpse to look at to tell us anything more about them. They're there, and then everyone dies, and then they're not there anymore.
Yeah, they are just this almost a sort of force of nature kind of on Necromunda.
Mm, they're like the bogeyman story, aren't they?
Yeah, yes. The Baba Yaga.
That many John Wicks would be a bad thing.
Yeah, exactly. So in terms of actually playing the Ash Waste Nomads, I have noticed from observing my friend who's playing them for the first time and kind of poking around at the list and looking at them, they require some finesse. You have to really kind of pick a strategy with them. And I think that they play very differently between the Hive and out in the Wastes. And we kind of talked about this earlier. It wasn't quite in the order of the questions that we asked, but I thought we'd jump into that a little bit here. So, you know, the differences in terms of what you think is the best way to kind of deal with those different environments. Lee, can we start with you?
Sure. I mean, I played them. So we played an Outlands campaign because, Dixie, we haven't gone into the actual Ash Waste proper. And I thought I'd try and do something super narrative, as I always try and do. And so I played Ash Waste Nomads in the Outlands, and I played them as a kind of a raiding war party coming to the inland, not because obviously they're not from the Outlands, they're from where they come. Anyway, so, and yeah, I mean, I kind of played them in a way that I thought they should be played, because of course, you know, kitted out with long rifles and big choppy axes and all that kind of stuff, and found very quickly that the things you think they're probably quite good at, they're not necessarily as good as you think they are. My biggest issue was, you know, the Helamites, the bugs, as I like to call them, with the chain lances, and you go, yeah, they can move 16 and, you know, I can charge in, and inevitably 9 times out of 10 they killed themselves because they failed an initiative test and they, you know, went over the handlebar. And that was a bit of a shock. You know, they are the definition of glass cannon to me. And so I think there are a number of things. There's a nuance to them, especially in the way that the skills need to be stacked and the tactics cards need to be stacked and the gear that they don't have to start off with needs to be stacked. And that's something that I haven't even come close to mastering yet.
No, that's fair. Gaz, how about you? What do you think about kind of playing them in different environments?
I feel like maybe quite rightly, they, at least to begin with in a campaign, that they exceed in the conditions of the Ash Waste. So that, you know, that 5+ environmental save that their Ash Cloaks give them. In the test games that I've played with Dixie, you know, that's come into effect. I think we had Boiling Winds, and if you have any armor, you had to, you know, take a save basically every turn after activating. It's surprising how many times that 5+ just saved them from, you know, going down. So you've got that initial advantage. But of course, if you're not playing in the Wastelands, then, you know, a lot of their equipment and a lot of their playstyle doesn't really kind of synergize within the Hive. And you know, I suppose that's intentional in a way. I think they're I wouldn't say they're a one-trick pony, but they seem to lack the broad flexibility that some of the, you know, like the six clan houses have.
Yeah, it's interesting that definitely the fact that they are carrying the kind of cost of that extra equipment, it influences how many of them you can take, and it does kind of make them less viable in the Hive environment, where you're not going to be using that tech as much. Like, even the respirator, like, gas weapons are not that common. You know, that it's one of those things where it's really useful in the Wastes, because when you get that mission where you can only make where movement becomes a basic action, when you get the weather effect where movement becomes a basic action, if you don't have a respirator, it's brutal. If you know, if you're playing against an Ash Waste Nomads gang and they all have respirators, they absolutely swarm you. I mean, you just get completely outmaneuvered, and there's nothing you could do about it, which is pretty great.
It feels to me like they are symbiotic with the weather effects. I think there's a lot of stuff that, if the weather's going right for them, and of course you can manipulate the visibility if you choose to, you can really lean in and really, but equally, I've played games where, you know, like, you know, they can hide in the Waste, great, but then the weather effects or the terrain effects, where if you don't move, you take damage, and so all of a sudden that negates completely their ability to hide, because you've got to keep them moving.
True.
But yeah, it's kind of the random element of that I love, but equally it can really kick you in the what's it.
Yeah, although, you know, you do have the 5+, which a lot of the other gangs don't have, so there is that.
True. I'm a little bit laissez-faire about 5+ saves, because having played a demon army in 5th edition 40k, where the whole army had a 5+ save, and it was like, well, doesn't really do a lot. I'm like, okay, great. It's a nice add, but I'm not going to rely on it.
For sure. Let's see. Dixie, how about you? What do you think about the different environments?
Well, they're obviously designed for Ash Wastes. Bringing them into the Hive, particularly I think in the narrative way like Lee did in our campaign, is great. They're a gang I wouldn't recommend to any kind of new Necromunda players. I think they're clearly a challenge to play, and they're a challenge to play for experienced Necromunda players anyway. So you've really got to lean into their strengths and spend quite a lot of time working out how you want to play them, and then build the list around that.
That makes a lot of sense.
Selection of people and a selection of weapons, and hoping you get some right, you know, the right tactics cards to use them effectively. You're not gonna work, basically.
There's a few
ways to play them, but yeah, I think you've got to find that focus and build around it.
So jumping off from this discussion, the Ash Waste Nomads have access to a variety of skills, and I think a lot of them are really great. Which skills do you guys like in particular? Gaz, we'll start with you.
I think the big one that everyone's raving about is Bring It Down, you know, being able to reroll hits. So whether you're, you know, fishing for sixes to try and make the most of that shock trait, and, you know, leaning into that with your whole list, or whether you're just running, you know, some cheap juves with auto guns, and just trying to, you know, beat people down with volume of fire, I think that's a, you know, a fantastic skill. But I've lent into the Savant tree quite a lot with the list I'm building for James's upcoming Ash Waste campaign, because I kind of like the kind of vibe of my Watcher. No, not the Watcher, the Stormcaller. There we go. The Stormcaller sort of being this kind of tribal kind of go-to guy for trading. And it's allowed me some fun modeling opportunities and stuff. So, yeah, they've got access to some of the great, you know, the great skill trees out there with cunning and shooting and far shot, Overwatch. I don't think the skills is where they lack at all. I think it's more built into their stats and their starting gear lists, maybe.
Yeah, as someone who's playing Cawdor and dealing with some really weird skill options that they've decided to impose on the Cawdor gags, it's definitely, you look at the Nomads, you're like, damn, like, I wish I had that.
Yeah.
Dixie, how about you?
Well, I think it depends on how you set them up. As Gaz said, they've got some access to some very interesting skills. Personally, I've lent very heavily into using the leader as a support character with Overseer, and then using him to trigger either the Stormcaller to be able to use his ability to control the visibility twice, in doing that twice in one turn, bringing the visibility down by 12 can really help. And once he's done that, using his ability to trigger Fast Shot on the Watcher twice in one turn, and to get, you know, because you're going to have fewer gangers generally. So the more shots you can get off, the better. But in terms of the actual, yeah, bring it down, I think, you know, you can potentially stack that as well, which is quite interesting with the right equipment to back it up. Because again, there's, you know, it's all well and good, but there's not a lot of point using it just with long rifles and blast rifles, etc. Marksman and precision shot play very well as alongside their blast shock weapons to trigger armor saves, etc. And then any of the savant skills, savvy trader, Vixo, etc., to generate income if you need it. So I think, again, it really comes down to how you play them and build the skills around that.
Makes sense. And Lee, how about you? Which skills do you like?
I'm going to reiterate what the guys say. I mean, when I ran my gang, I was using Fast Shot on my Watcher. I didn't stack it with Overseer, should have. But no, I mean, that worked really, really nicely, especially with the improved ballistic skill of the Watcher, you know, getting that number of shots off, putting them at the back, pinging people off. Fixer, in early game, I think a lot of people overlook Fixer. I mean, I think people go for like the more offensive skills, but just the ability to, you know, very reliably generate D3 times 10 credits, especially for someone that you kind of hover at the back. For me, the Stormcaller would be the perfect thing to put that one onto, because you can sit him at the back, play with the weather, and he's going to generate you D3 times 10 credits. I've seen builds on Yak Tribe where people are sort of talking about the same sort of thing. I mean, and specifically from their list, I mean, I'm always drawn to Born to the Waste because I'd like it to be better than it is. And, you know, we'll get into why that doesn't work very well because of their base equipment. But equally, I mean, Eyes of the Wasteland should be awesome because, you know, increasing their range from other stuff and all the rest of it. But in practice, it doesn't really work that well.
That's fair. I definitely think that there's some there's always some winners and losers in the skill tree department, where it feels like they have an idea of how something should work, but it doesn't quite play out in terms of the, you know, the reality. I think that there's a Van Sar one where you're irradiated and glow, and the way the rule works mechanically, it just kind of is there's no reason you would take it other than the fact that you want a guy who glows. As someone who takes that on one of my guys, it was only a narrative choice.
Right. No, I have to, that one passed me by, but it seems, unless there's a particular reason for like the guy's a decoy in a pitch black game or something like that, you know, it seems a bit iffy.
Yeah. So, you know, moving on from skills, talking about gear, what equipment do you think works really well with the Ashwaste Nomads? And we can talk about kind of both the trading post stuff and the houseless stuff. And Dixie, we'll start with you.
So I think in terms of their standard list, there's nothing in that in terms of actual equipment that jumps out particularly. The blast weapons are nice, the shock trait, etc. That, you know, they've got some strengths there, but fundamentally the weapons are not that interesting. I think it's when you start combining it with equipment from the trading post and the war gear that they have access to that things become more interesting. So the ability for their gangers to take long rifles as basic weapons suddenly means you can start putting things like gun shrouds on them and then combining that with their cheap infrasights at half price and the sky mantles. You know, you start having gangers who can burrow into the sand and then can start shooting in the dark or in the reduced visibility without revealing themselves and things. And not because you're hidden, you're not able to be charged and people have to come close, and then you've got lots of other kind of supporting possibilities and equipment that can benefit that as well.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept. Like, you know, sort of relying on being hidden and the opponent having to come to you in order to spot you, and then having counter chargers kind of in place to deal with them is something I hadn't really thought about as kind of a strategy to really harass someone and surprise them.
So some of the other thing that's worth pointing out is their combat equipment, other than the chain lance, which it looks good, but it's expensive and I don't think it's worth taking. The combat weapons generally give them a +1 to hit at long range, which most people miss the fact that that also works with the visibility rules. So your knives and things that they've got are helping you in combat. So if people are going to have, you know, if you're going to take the visibility down and force them to come close in order to deal with you, you've then got that counteractive bonus when you're charging and dealing with melee, because they're not that good at shooting, they're not that good at combat. They're kind of in the middle somewhere. You just got to play into the strengths of combinations of weapon, war gear, and skills to make it work.
Yeah, it's a finesse approach, more so than kind of the, you know, Vansar, you know, you just buy lots of guns and you can kind of sit back and shoot, or, you know, Escher or Goliath, you're going to, you know, buy a lot of fighty guys and you're going to get in there and, you know, have different strategies for making it work. But like fundamentally, it sort of makes sense how you use them, you know, it's very kind of linear, but the Nomads are a little bit more dicey. You got to kind of work it out.
Yeah, you'll find it will generally go really well or really badly.
Lee, what do you think? Which stuff do you like?
I think Dixie's hit it absolutely nail on. I mean, for me, narratively, the point he makes about gun shrouds, and we've talked at length about this, it seems completely odd that that's not in their base list, because why would, you know, an organization that relies on hiding in the dunes have to go to the trading post to be able to do that? It just seems completely bass awkward to me, and that's probably because if you gave it to them straight out of the gate, they would be so overpowered that it then becomes broken and it's a way to balance it. But it does, narratively, it just seems balked. As Dixie said, I mean, you know, having run the gang, you know, my rush of blood to the head, I'll put chain lances because of the box art, you know, I'll put them on the bugs and they'll charge in. And when they go in, they are horrifying. I mean, you know, they are doing strength 6, AP -2, you know, they're nasty. They will kill pretty much whatever they charge, unless you happen to go after some hulking Goliath something. However, they're glass cannons, and you fail an initiative roll and they're going to kill themselves because they'll move too far and then they go over the handlebars. The other stuff, I mean, on our podcast, we've talked at length about my displeasement about certain weapons being completely ineffectual against vehicles. You know, I was playing against a Goliath gang with a Mauler, and I went up with it with a Venomcaster, and it was like, well, it's a toxin weapon, it doesn't do anything. And you think, but it's a bike. But it's not a bike. Anyway, that's an issue I have.
Yeah.
There are some weapons that not just Nomads, but other people that seem to be a bit ineffectual in the waste themselves. And again, I love the shock weapons, the blast weapons. But again, fishing for sixes is, when you don't get that six, they're a bit meh.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, it's like a worse auto gun without the six.
Exactly. So, you know, and like Dixie says, you know, adding on all the marksmen and the precision shot, and I've now gone on Reddit, so after, you know, I get an opportunity to say it and not make a fool of myself like I did before, but no, you're still fishing for those sixes. And that, you know, 1 in 6 chance of getting it, it's going to happen maybe once or twice a game, depending on how many times you actually get the shot off because of the range of the thing. Okay, fine. And I think we've all kind of come to the conclusion that they're very whelming. You know, they're not overwhelming, they're not underwhelming, but they're just their gear is whelmed by it. And I think the trading post is really where you have the opportunity to make them shine by giving them something, you know, buying things like, you know, nasty black market weapons or static rounds or whatever it is. But yeah, having played them, yeah, they're okay.
Gaz, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, I could just echo the same points that, you know, Lee and Dixie have brought out, but I think there's a lot of variety to the way you could play them. I mean, initially I looked at the Venomcaster and the Webgun and was thinking, yeah, but you know, we're outdoors, we're not in Zone Mortalis, so it's going to be quite hard to bunch people up. But then I'm thinking, well, transport beds. So if you chuck those on a, you know, prospect later on in the campaign, you know, maybe start them off with some lighter gear. And you know, once you've got a bit more creds from leaning into the savant tree, maybe you just, you know, overwatch that juve a bit closer and then, or prospect, sorry, and then, you know, hit the transport bed with a Weber at strength five. And you know, that's going to mess up somebody's day, right? Or the same with the Venom caster, you know, it's ignoring that armor and stuff that they've got, you know. So I think there's options there. It's just a lot of the good stuff's expensive. You know, you're going to have to very much think about your build. You're going to be unlikely to chuck a list together that's going to be effective without really thinking about the strategies you're going to employ. And for a gang that's meant to be fluff-wise centered around raiding convoys, I think initially they lack quite a lot of options, yeah. Especially when you look at the statuses that affect vehicles, as Lee's pointed out. And I think, as you know, that harks back to what James said about it's not really a gang for first-time Necromunda players. It's probably not a gang for, you know, most Necromunda players, and you know, like a challenge.
Yeah, vehicles are kind of an odd element in the game in that they break a lot of the kind of core assumptions about how models interact, and you have to really adjust to their playstyle. But it doesn't feel like the Ash Waste Nomads are really built with that in mind, and I don't fully understand why that is. And it's something that's kind of prickled me ever since they first came out almost a year ago. That there's this sort of disconnect, because that as a gang, it feels like they should be ideally suited for taking on a vehicle. But it doesn't quite work that way in game. And I think that even, like, for example, the squats got a tactics card that lets them, you know, force a vehicle to go out of gas or whatever and become stationary installed. And the Nomads don't really have an equivalent to that. And it's like, that's the kind of thing that really would make sense to me for them, because that's one of the things that the gang would be doing, is setting a trap or something that's going to mess with their mobility. But so I think that there's some room for improvement there. I think subsequent releases or something would be a nice way to do it. Cause right now, as it stands, it doesn't feel like they're getting a ton more attention. You know, they've got their Brute, they've got their prospects box, like what else is coming for them? But I do think that they could use maybe maybe an article in the Warhammer Apocrypha Necromunda, like something like that, where they kind of expand on them a little bit. Something to help them in this environment where they struggle would really be nice. But I will say that I do like the Weber, as you were saying, for dealing with trucks that are driving around with a bunch of people in them, because my one friend's squats are constantly driving around in a rock grinder, and they're all riding in the back, and they're all guns blazing out of that thing, and it's brutal. And you know, the rock grinder is a very tough vehicle. It's very hard to stop, especially as an Ash Waste Nomads player. But if you can even just seriously injuring one of them, and you know, starting to cause those cascading you know, cool checks to see if they run and all that stuff, watching people book off of their transport vehicle and right into the hands of your opponent is always very satisfying. So there's definitely situations where those weapons are useful, but I don't think that they should be taken right out of the gate, because you wind up needing to kind of adapt to what your opponent's play styles are.
Sorry, guys, go on.
No, sorry. I was just going to say, like, you've kind of hit the nail on the head there. It's very expensive straight out the gate. And actually, why invest into that, you know, post game one or two, when you could pretty much achieve the same sort of stuff with a cheaper hand flamer or an incendiary grenade or anything like that that's going to make those fighters kind of book it off the back of the transport bed and throw the entire formation into disarray. You can have the same or better effect for a lot less creds, and actually, weirdly, they don't come with any grenades in any of, like, no fighter can access grenades, not a photon flash for disabling a vehicle or a concussion grenade to affect its handling. Like you said, there's no mines. There's the one mined card, but I think from memory that just forces a loss of control test, and that's it, just one and done.
Right.
They're kind of missing like a shock mine, or you know, a flash or concussion mine, something like that that they could deploy. But you know, like maybe they'll fill it out in a future book. I live in hope.
It was the point I was going to make about, you know, if you think about it, you know, they don't even have the equivalent of a Molotov cocktail, like a, you know, an incendiary grenade. That seems lacking somewhat, you know, and having tried to take vehicles down, like you say, the rock grinder, you know, with even if you don't put a transport cage in, because of course then, you know, you can't attack the guys in there. They're very hard, and that ability to take on vehicles, let alone take down vehicles, you know, with a flamer or something like that, all of a sudden it becomes doable. I mean, we've talked internally about the Goonhammer article about, you know, you can take it down with a las pistol. Well, yes, you can take it down with a las pistol, but are you going to? No. I think going back to that comment about the lack of, say, the gun shroud, their available weapon / equipment options are, I think, quite lacking. And why do you rely on the trading post? It's a little bit like one of my original beefs with OG N17. If you remember way back in the day, where the house pets were only available from the trading post, and it's like,
yep.
Oh, I'm a Goliath and I want a sump croc, but I have to go to the sump croc dealer at the end. What's going on with I never understood that, and then they've changed it now so you can take, and it feels the same sort of thing. Like, it's almost a regression of this thinking of, oh no, you go to the trading post to buy stuff. And it's like, why? They're in the middle of the desert. There isn't a trading post. What are you doing?
Yeah, I think that it would be nice, certainly, to have just a little bit more in their equipment list. And I wouldn't even mind if they were restricted from going to the trading post if their list was a little bit more thorough. Stuff like suspensors for the, you know, for the guns. I mean, you know, when you make the comparison to like the Fremen, one of their like secrets was that they actually had like a really advanced industry for making these very specialized things for the environment that they were fighting in. And that was part of what made them so much better than the people they were fighting, and able to do these kind of, you know, sneak attacks, because they were able to survive in, you know, the harsh conditions, hide so much better and all that stuff. And, you know, kind of translating that into Necromunda, it does feel like just a little bit of extra stuff in the trading post or in the house list would have made a big difference for them.
Although we should point out that you've mentioned one of the pet peeves of Lawrence, one of the other members of Guildersford Radio, who he distinctly hates suspensors because he thinks that they break everything.
It's quite funny. I mean, it's not wrong. Like, the whole point of a heavy weapon is that it's a heavy weapon, and you add a suspensor to it, and suddenly it's like, well, what's the downside of this?
Exactly.
It's cost you a fighter, isn't it? Basically, it's the cost of a fighter to have that. So, yeah, it's a bit of give and take. I can kind of see, but I think your point there, which I think really stands out, is like, if you watch the opening scene of the latest Dune film, that kind of encapsulates for me the attack on the spice crawler, what the Nomad's style should be, you know, a big opening boom, and then a couple of, you know, crazed warriors leap from the sand, sword in hand, and start slicing people down and catching them unawares. And unfortunately, I think that's the thing that I so far have found missing from their actual playstyle, is that
everyone has.
You don't really want to get them into combat like that. That's not really where they exceed. You could maybe take a couple of cheap gangers with a stalking knife and a blast pistol. I think that from just off the top of my head, that's probably setting you back about 85 credits for a one trick pony that you've got to get in close enough. And even then, I think they're only hitting in the viz on about 3+. So it's a bit lackluster for that kind of power fantasy, if you want to live that.
I think they're actually probably just best ignoring vehicles. Like, their strengths are not taking vehicles down. Their strengths are in taking down gangers. And you've only, you know, with the amount of credits most players, if my group or anything to go by, are sinking into their vehicles, they've only got six or seven gangers. You've only got to take out three of them and you're bottling. And then the crew get out of the vehicle and abandon it. And then they can loot it at their leisure.
I was going to say...
We're leaning in, a lot of our guys are leaning into are things like the transport cages. And so, you know, I've had a lot of games, especially with like Lawrence, for example, where the guys just aren't getting out of that bit and they're sitting and they're shooting. And so if you can't get through the armor to deal with them, you are basically unable to... do anything about
it. They've got to get out at some point if they want to achieve the mission objectives. They're going to drive up to something, and you've got all the time in the world to stay out of range, bring the visibility down, and wait for them.
Completely valid. Assuming they're playing the objective, yes.
And if they're putting all their eggs in that basket, it does allow you to kind of try to more focus on that sort of bring it down with massed blast shooting kind of approach. You can kind of gauge what your opponent's going for and then build in the sort of direction to adapt to what they're taking. And you do have options because even, you know, having if they have the open vehicles, those charge caster, the pie plates from the charge caster, getting to re-roll to hit, and fishing for sixes from bring it down, you can really do, some serious damage to someone who's, you know, they got half their crew in the back of a vehicle. If you're hitting, you know, if it's not a transport cage, which the transport cage does have a disadvantage, which is that you can only take it on those custom vehicles, and the custom vehicles are definitely a little jankier in terms of their stats than the sort of fixed, you know, the ridge hauler and all that stuff.
Yep.
So I do think that there is an opportunity for kind of counterplay there, but it's going to take people kind of experimenting and finding what works for them.
No, I mean, we have at length talked about the difference between the, you know, the kind of the standard vehicles and then the kind of the junkyard vehicles and all the rest of it. And I think initially I was guilty of this, not thinking about it in terms of exactly that. You know, Dixie made a very eloquent point about the fact that the standard vehicles are exactly that. They're standard template construct things. They can be produced en masse there. Everyone's got the parts. And you build something completely random, and it's the equivalent of you strapping something completely outlandish to your truck and taking it down the local shop and going, fix it for me, right? So, you know, that kind of thing is,
This guy here, I took like the treads off of those servitor guys, and I like just strapped a transport bed to the back of it. I just added this to my Condor gang.
So, you know, so in that regard, that's not standard, and that's, you know, parts for that are going to be completely kind of rare. And so you take that hit for picking something cool that you, if it breaks, you're going to have problems fixing it. And I think that's something we haven't really had that much experience of yet. But I think going forward, especially in a campaign, we probably will.
And if you're playing a true Ash Wastes campaign, the costs of maintaining vehicles really start to add up because you are not getting nearly as much income as you would be in, you know, a Dominion campaign where you've got all of these territories that are producing tons of cash. The roadways are not the like credit farm that, you know, a lot of the other campaign territories are.
I've just put the map and the road network details together for our campaign, and I think people are going to be surprised when they see it.
That's awesome. Well, a lot of these questions have kind of started to gel together. So I think we can kind of, we've covered a lot of the topics that I wanted to kind of get into, but why don't we kind of open it up a little bit? Is there anything about the gang in particular that you want to expound more on? And Gaz, we'll start with you.
Anything more that I sort of want to just sort of broach, you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, we've spoken a lot about vehicles and how do they deal with vehicles. And this is something I actually reached out to Kev Fowler from Goonhammer about. And they revisited a previous article about the Ridge Hauler, about getting into melee with vehicles and how that ability to roll two location dice and pick the result obviously gives you a bit more control over how you can control that particular battlefield situation. But what we didn't kind of broach at the time was about how the different status effects can mount up on a vehicle, and I think I've come up with a bit of a hierarchy and a strategy for, you know, if you, especially with Nomads, if you apply Bring It Down and then you start hitting it with things such as Concussion, so then it's at a -2, then you start hitting it and trying to aim for the let me get this right, the drive, I think, you know, try and get a penetrating on the drive, or depending on what you roll, you can just look at the table before you select and think, right, I want to go for the ones that take another -1 to the handling test. And all it says right at the start of that, you know, that damage table section for the vehicles, that everything is cumulative. So if you keep doing that turn on turn and start really focusing fire on that ridge hauler or that, you know, that big Goliath truck, you know, and you're controlling the visibility, so in turn your guys aren't getting pinned, the action economy is in your favor, eventually that vehicle's gonna either jackknife or it's gonna stall. You know, hit it with a flash, can't activate, can't move. Those guys in the transport cage are going to have to get out and footslog if they want to secure the objective or get in the fight. So there's options that I think people are ignoring or haven't explored yet, because I don't think many people are leaning into the Ash Waste campaign because it's kind of half-baked at the minute, right? A lot of the gangs have their stuff.
That's a really good point, particularly like the fact that you could hit any part of the vehicle with the photon flash and it'll have to make that handling check to see if they can't activate next turn. That can be an absolute game changer, particularly if your opponent put a lot of credits into the guns on a truck, suddenly right. Not having any ability to use it the next turn. Like, not only is that them, you know, potentially falling behind in a rolling road game, but that's those guns not shooting for an entire turn, which is a pretty big impact.
Well, half the time, all you've got to do is hit it and cause it to swerve and it's facing the wrong way.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That makes a big difference. Activation
getting back on target before it can open fire.
You know, and if they've got firing ports and they're not facing now in the direction, you know, it's something that I think, because the majority of players haven't played it yet. It's a bit like when Corpse Grinders came out and everybody were like, oh my God, these are overpowered. How'd you get around the masks? And now everybody has got, you know, reasonable strategies for, you know, counteracting a lot of the stuff. And
They're rubbish.
Yeah, Lee's not had a lot of luck with them either.
It's a funny one. I mean, like, it's one of those situations where, you know, it really depends on your environment and kind of what you're up against and what you're taking. Because if you are taking grenade launchers, flamers, web guns, corpse grinders are, you know, I mean, they're going to come right into range of your weapons and get nuked.
I played Dixie with them, and he just took a Vansar gang with las guns, and he just mowed me down. It was like, combat? What combat, right? You know,
if you have multiple plasma guns, it doesn't really matter if you're not going to be able to shoot them with every single one of them, because one plasma gun hitting is going to do plenty.
Exactly. You know, and just pinning them. I mean, the whole kind of, even not even killing them, just stopping them doing their thing is enough. And that's exactly what, you know, just pin everyone and it's like, oh, okay, I'm done now.
No, that
has been my experience with Corpse Grinders, is that they...
That's what makes Escher, I think, such an interesting close combat gang, because Spring Up is like the one antidote. I know obviously you can take...
Nerves of Steel, that's it.
Yeah, Nerves of Steel. So, you know, Nerves of Steel is okay, but Spring Up is so much better because you get the benefit of kind of going to ground and being less easy to shoot and getting better cover and all that. And then you get up for free and you get to activate as normal. It's an absolute mean. You take too much of it, it can start to be kind of irritating.
We don't have one.
Spring Up is an excellent skill for anyone with a mount.
Oh my God, yes. Oh my God.
I mean, so we don't have our two Escher special
basic action for free, rather than having to do, you're doing the initiative test to Spring Up anyway. You just bypass the getting back on the bike action.
And interestingly, agility is a secondary skill for the Hellamites.
That's true. We don't have our two Escher specialists with us because, of course, the thing that we're dealing with, you know, what the chems do and, you know, things like, and all the toxin weapons that Escher have, you know, that's they're horrifying for me. You know, toxin completely bypassing everything and just, you know, killing. I mean, my June Scuttler Twinkle died to a toxin weapon, and you think, oh, this has got 5 wounds and it's super tough, and it's like, no, dead.
Yep.
So I haven't really played Escher all that much, and what you can do with chems and toxin,
Yeah. All right. So let's see. Is there anything overall that you think, you know, is an obvious fix for kind of making this gang work a little bit closer to how you imagine them in the background or what have you?
I think there's a couple of interesting omissions, I guess, that just things that you can kind of see where the designers were going, but it doesn't quite work with the rules. I mean, one of the really obvious ones is like the Helimites, which are very clearly giant fleas intended for bouncing around and jumping, can't jump over things.
Or up things.
Or up things. They can't climb. You know, I get that they're a mount and that opening mounts up to climbing terrain causes a lot of possibility of jankiness, but, you know, the ability for one of them to just jump over a ridge hauler and attack something on the other side of it, for example, would be thematic and so hilarious.
The thing I found with that is if they have that skill, where is it? The flight, which is basically allows them to jump across. So, like, if here's a gap, you can jump across. So great in a Zone Mortalis game or even a Sector Mechanicus game, but you can't then apply that to, oh, here's a piece of like big terrain in front of me that I can effectively jump over. No, it doesn't work like that. And you think, really?
Or even a small barricade or whatever, you still got to go around it and climb over it. So,
You think, well, how often are you going to be jumping across something because they're in the ash way? So how many like craters and stuff are in the ash way that they're jumping across as opposed to up and over?
Just one thing on the barricade thing. We wound up looking this up because of a game we were playing. Specifically, if it's less than a 1-inch barrier, they can do it. They just have to use the movement to get over it. But it's still very silly to not have the ability to just jump over obstacles when it's a flea. I mean, you have any idea how high a flea can jump relative to its body height? It's insane.
It seems a bit odd to me, especially.
Right, I think that's one sort of obvious fix, I think, is giving them something, you know, because it's not, again, that's not really game breaking. It would be another unique aspect to them, because having, you know, they have a prospect that comes with a mount, great, but that's not, now that you're in the ash waste, that's not unique. So yeah, they're missing something on that element. I think a little bit more attention to the war gear and the weapons that they have access to straight out the bat, I think, would have been nice.
And I think that's something that's relatively easy for an arbitrator to fix, you know, just kind of tweaking the list a little bit is not too bad. And it could give your Ash Waste Nomads player a little bit of a boost if you're worried about them struggling.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it'll be interesting once we do a full campaign to see what, not even just restricted to Nomads, but across the whole plethora of gangs that you've got, you know, what people are going to learn from this and how they would then approach another Ash Waste campaign.
I mean, for me on that regard, I think it's going to be interesting because, of course, you've got the gangs that have specific Ash Waste stuff, you know, the cutters and the maulers and all that kind of stuff. But then you've got the other gangs, the Vansar, and, I mean, okay, Cawdor kind of have it, but there are no rules. So what's going on there? Yeah, so how are those gangs going to deal with it? And of course they can go and get vehicles, you know, they can do the sort of the junkyard vehicles, but I think I'd like to see how all the gangs fare, because at the moment there is a sort of a dichotomy between those with and those without the rules, and there has been, as we've said previously, there's quite a gap in, you know, where's the next book or the update and all the rest of it. Specifically
where is it?
Exactly. Specific. I mean, the thing for me, and I'm not quite sure, you know, we've talked to June quite a lot, the gaping hole, other than the stuff, you know, like the war gear tweaks, all the rest of it, is where is their vehicle equivalent? I mean, you know, these people can go and buy a honking great ridge hauler, and it's very explicit that Ash Waste Nomads can't do this. I mean, they can't even go and salvage one that they found in the waste, which seems odd, right? Why can't you do that? But then, okay, fine, they can't do that. So where is their big critter?
Right, like if we're talking about these guys as sort of the, you know, the equivalent of Fremen ride sandworms, that's like their whole thing. You know, the sand people ride banthas, like having a transport bug just seems like common sense, and yet we don't have any sign of anything like that coming, and I'm kind of scratching my head about it. I actually I went ahead and built like a dinosaur, because I was looking at old Ash Wastes magazine articles from back in the, I think, the Fanatic days, or maybe even before that. And they were playing with these tiny little dinosaur toys that were being used as you know, transports. And I had this STL file for a Triceratops, and I was like, I could do that. And so that's the genesis of this. We haven't played with it yet. I haven't really come up with an idea of even how to use it. But like, I think that you know, giving the player an option for something for Ash Wastes that's beyond the kind of lists of what they already have, some kind of vehicle equivalent, makes sense to me. Even if it's just accounts as, like, they can buy a vehicle, but it counts as like a, you know, a transport bug or something, would be nice.
Other people other than the prospects to take the mount.
Yes. And I think that's true for all gangs, not just Ash Wastes.
Well, no, I mean, everyone can take the dirt bike.
Yeah, that's the thing. Is the dirt bike is like every single model, I think, except other models that already have stuff like jump packs and cutter or whatever, can take a waste or dirt bike, except the Nomads. And like, it strikes me as odd that you could take an all mounted list except for your leader. Like, you could take two Stormcallers as your, you know, champions. You could take the rest of your gang as prospects, but your leader does not have a way to get on a bug. And it's just, that doesn't make sense to me.
The skill that makes him movement 8 if he starts on the battlefield surface, but it's still, it's a weird way of doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the only way to get a champ with one is to, you know, get a prospect and then raise them to watcher so they take it with them. But even so, like, looking at the watchers and the way they're built, you don't want to build them, you know, their equipment doesn't really lend itself most of the time, and you don't want to put them in that sort of position of flanking and getting up close and securing objectives necessarily.
Right. Yeah, that's true. I have kind of a silly list written up that's got like 8 or 9 bugs in it that it's a little over the top, but I want to run it at some point just to see, like, if you just go full in on the bug thing, like, does that weight of numbers suddenly make them more effective? But we'll have to see.
I still think the mounts, a lot of people get the wrong impression of the mounts, and like they immediately go, you know, as Lee did, stick a chain lance on it and charge it in as quickly as possible.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Not going to work. The way I've been putting long lasses on them and leaving them at the back to move into better shooting positions, or if there isn't anything to shoot at, to start, you know, zipping around the sides out of visibility range in order to get objectives.
Yeah.
They seem much better suited for that than they are for actually charging in tan-tan combat as a glass cannon.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, unless it happens to be something that is relatively weak, James Dixie's absolutely right. I mean, that you get that rush of blood to the head and go, ha-ha, right, I have a chain lance, and I'm mounted and I can do all this stuff. And you know, if you actually, like I said, get into combat with them, they can be very amazing, but I don't think that's the way they're supposed to be played. I got the Ash Wastes box for Christmas, and I have, another set. So I potentially could put 8 down and the Stormcrawler, a bit like you were talking. And I toyed with the idea, and all the Ash Wastes guys are still on the sprue from the box. I'm like, probably not going to do that now. Because I think it'd be really interesting to hear what your experiences of running a mass bugged list is. But I don't think I'll be doing it myself.
Yeah, it's a very specific thing to do. I'm not quite sure if it'll work. But it's, I like to go kind of silly with my themes at times. Obviously, I have a, you know, like a 60-foot tall tank that I'm rolling around with in the Ashways. So, you know, I'm not always going for what's the most effective approach to the game.
No, narrative is where it's at, right? And I think that's the thing we should all be leaning into, because there is no competitive element of this game, which is phenomenal as far as I'm concerned. And I think, you know, because you've got awesome arbitrators like Dixie and others who can control what you're doing and not have people do insanely stupid things, or stop people who have done insanely stupid things in our case, you know, do that kind of stuff. And it's good, right?
I will say that one of my favorite tactics cards for the Nomads is the one where you can get three of the Juves to come, or I think it's D3 Juves to come in. And they can take blast rifles, like, you know, for free. And that is a really nice way to kind of take a list that's got, say, 11, 12 models in it. And suddenly you've got 15 models, you know, and you're not going to bottle. And that's on top of whatever your starting crew is. You don't have to, you know, you don't have to slot them in to your, you know, normal starting crew limit. And suddenly the Ash Waste Nomads become very overwhelming when you have access to that.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, actually, they get 20 creds of equipment, so 15 creds for the blast rifle, and you're golden.
Yep.
Yeah. You play the other one part way through to bring, you know, somebody for you to get taken out of action and bring them back on again.
Yep. All right. Yeah, I mean, go ahead.
So I was just going to say, like, that I've got that tactic card in mind, and it, I've actually gone and modelled three old Chaos cultists and green stuff them quite heavily, and I was going to say the thing that I've enjoyed most about taking on the Nomads is that freedom of creativity, just kind of try and make them your own, because like you said, they're not really there's a load of mystery around them still, and they're not quite fully fleshed out. I think there's a lot of creative freedom there, which you know, is a fantastic thing to explore.
I mean, it was interesting. Gaz was, you know, one of your questions was, you know, what do you like converting about them?
And
Gaz,
I was about to say,
he's gone absolutely to town on, and both and Dixie as well have done some phenomenal conversions. And my response was, I haven't done any, and I'm probably not going to, because I've started another complete conversion on a different gang.
They're a beautiful gang stock. Like, they look really cool and unique and special. They've got a great beast handler hanger on. They've got a great bug. You know, there's plenty of of good there, just in stock in terms of what their gang looks like. But in that vein, do you guys want to? Yes, yeah, it's a big old bug.
That's Twinkle. so that's an STL from the Infestation.
Yeah, yeah.
Kickstarter thing.
Currently loose in Fugitive's Drift.
Yes, at the end of the campaign, the handler just let it loose into Fugitive's Drift, so it's doing its thing somewhere. But
yeah, and this guy's my take, which is another STL file, but this one is from Edge Miniatures, which is their sort of like Tyranid-esque. They're a little bit more Starship Troopers Bugsy style, and I like that it was different from Tyranids, because I don't want to put a Tyranid on the table. You know, it's too obvious.
Yeah, Gene Sealers in Beta Hive. You know, what's to say? Yeah,
that's a separate thing. They definitely. There's Gene Sealer cult is the current bad guys in my campaign, so I definitely am using those. But I didn't want to put Carnifex or whatever down, because it just doesn't quite it breaks the immersion a little bit, I think. But you could definitely do some conversion work on them and get something good enough. Dixie, do you have any conversions that you like for this army or gang?
Yeah, I've been using quite a few cord orbits on them, because it fits surprisingly well, particularly the kind of, you know, the junkyard cobbled together weapons aspect. So, you know, I've used some of the long rifles and the auto gun arms and just some of the hands, and my Stormcaller is actually converted from one of the standard Helimites, but with a Cordor torso to get kind of long flowing robes, and then the head fits into the kind of neck really, really well, like nicely. So yeah, there's some good opportunities there. I mean, the gang, most of the gang is kind of stock models, can you say they're great straight out of the box anyway. I don't have a in between life and arbitration and everything else. I don't have a lot of time for painting and stuff at the moment. So all I've done literally is just slapped contrast on them to get the base coats, and then just covered them in weathering powder, and it's fine. So,
I mean, they would be filthy anyway, so that makes sense.
Exactly.
To look at oil washes, but you know, we'll get there slowly.
I swear by them. I do a lot of terrain, and without oil washes, I would be lost. I would have to be constantly leaving things to, you know, sit and then, you know, clean up all the coffee stain style issues and all that. Yeah. The oil washes are amazing. Gaz, how about you? What do you like for conversions for these guys?
I mean, the one of the first things I kind of deviated with was I made a rogue doc using the veteran guardsman medic. And from there it's kind of snowballed. I've got bits of ad mech that have just arrived, some crew, long rifles and pouches and things. I've got plans to make a slopper using some Age of Sigmar bits and pieces, you know, like bits of meat and stuff hanging off the sky mantle, like a drying rack for jerky. I've been using Cordor bits after seeing what James and some others have done, the Chaos Cultists, like I said, and even a couple of Gene Stealer cult bits here and there. I plan to share a bit more, but I'm kind of at this point where I don't really want to show too much ahead of the campaign in case people start planning around it. So
right. Yeah.
In due course.
I think that this is one where there's some decent options out there in the STL universe for options for kind of expanding on these. Print Minis has some really lovely proxies and equivalents. I've got a couple of them here. I'll slap pictures of them up during the video version of this. I'll overlay it or whatever because I don't have them easily close at hand. But also Station Forge has some really, they have some really lovely cultist models that very much fit the aesthetics of the
mechanical models. I mean, I've been doing something completely unrelated to Ash Waste but looking at their mechanical models going, you could just get away with a little bit of lose a few of the kind of mechanical arms. You could totally get away with those. They're great.
They've also got, go ahead.
The horses, the Deathcore horses, the basis for my Palanite in horses, as somebody called them. Horseback riding Palanite subjugators and stuff.
Yeah.
The other thing from an STL perspective, where I really tried to kind of make it work, but there's no sci-fi version, is the Bestiarium Games Penitent Crusade. That I love Bestiarium Games. I love the gothic kind of bent. I just wish they do kind of a sci-fi version of that, because I think that would be perfect.
I got one of their the Beastmen Shaman right on hand, because I absolutely adore their sculpts. I don't back them every month just because my budget's limited, but I'm planning to actually tomorrow when I get paid to back their current month, because they did an amazing Slaanesh wave that is quite disturbing to look at. I really like the opportunity to do models that are like really, really dark. Even though I prefer my stories to be on the silly side. I don't know what that is.
their way that they do stuff, I love their models are phenomenal. But and I've actually messaged them and said, have you ever thought about doing a kind of a sci-fi or add-on, weapon swaps and stuff, because I know some people do Heresy miniatures, or they do a sci-fi and a fantasy kind of weapon swap, and the Bestiarium stuff, if their Penitent Crusade had sci-fi, that would be redemption done.
Right, but it's not. But there is also STL kit bashing if you want to enter into that.
I do that a little bit. I've been playing with that, but I have to be honest with you, going completely off. I did that. I was doing some custom, and the digital version versus the physical print didn't quite do it for me. So I am going old school. I'm going back to the green stuff, and I'm going to old school it, because I'll print some parts and then I'll kit bash it physically, because I don't think my skills are really up to that yet.
I definitely do a mix, because it really depends on the mesh that you're working with, whether it's even going to be easy to pop stuff off or whatever. Sometimes you get in there and the geometry is a mess. It's like you start cutting things off and things start just happening wacky all over the place. It's like, I don't want to mess with this model. It prints okay as is. I can chop it apart with a scalpel and not have to deal with the whatever the sculptor's strange choices were.
Exactly.
All right. So I think that we mostly covered everything. We got it about an hour or so of chat time. And is there anyone you guys want to give a shout out to before we go? Lee, we'll start with you.
Well, no one other than please come and if you feel that way inclined to listen to Guilders 4 Radio, you can find us on all of the standard podcasting apps. Not to steal any of your listeners, of course. But
No. I put out one show a month right now. You know, absolutely. there's plenty of room for more Necromunda podcasts.
Exactly. Yeah. So we're on Apple, Spotify, Google, all the usual places. Yeah, that'd be great.
All right, Gaz, do you want to give anyone a shout out?
Well, all the big hitters in the community, really, for keeping it going and keeping everybody sort of inspired and answering each other's questions or sharing ideas. Everyone from sort of Goonhammer to yourself to Sump City Radio. It feels like a really great hobby space to be in the sense that everybody just wants to collaborate and make it great for each other, and nobody's really sort of like gatekeeping it as such. I don't feel I just want to introduce more people that are interested in dipping their toe into as Lee said, a game that doesn't really have a massive competitive edge. Like, yeah, you can strategize and have fun with it, but the real joy is in that, you know, overarching progressive narrative
The game is structured to kind of mess with you if you try to do that approach. Like, you know, the fact that you've got random deployments for who can come in and you've got, you know, random tactics cards and all that stuff mixed into the different missions. Depending on what mission you get, the game can really, you know, screw with your plans. If you're starting out with three guys and you're going to have to make bottle checks after your first casualty, no matter how many guys come in from reserves, you know, your OP list is not going to perform any better than someone who's playing with scrubs.
Oh, you're completely right. And also we've got a Dixie for that. You know, it's a one size fits all cure for anyone who's trying to be an asshat. So, you know, there you go.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
I bring my arbitration bell. I call out stuff when it's the people are taking the piss.
Yeah, I mean, for my most recent campaign, it's all been, you know, these video battle reports that I'm doing. So I'm like consciously trying to kind of mix up as many new missions as possible, just so we're not kind of getting repetitive and boring. And it's been a really fun chance for me to kind of like look at what the gang's strengths are and then try to kind of come up with missions that put them in weird positions. Like we did, I mean, I think this was actually straight out of the book, the like blockade mission using the Ashwaste Nomads, and the Nomad player got the tactics card because there's a component in my campaign where if you choose each round, whether you're on offense or defense, and if you choose to be on offense, then when you're attacking, you get the benefit of the picking your tactics cards and your crew. And if you pick defense and you're on defense, the same deal, and vice versa, you have to do random. So it adds kind of a little metagame component where you're having to think about what your gang wants to be doing for that round and whether, you know, you want to get the first in to challenge and be aggressive, or if you want to kind of, you know, play defensive. But we had the Ash Waste player with like 15 guys going up against this squat gang that had, I think, like six or seven models on the table, and like seeing the way that this sort of swarm, you know, just absorbed so much punishment because, you know, they just could keep coming because they're not going to bottle because they started with 15 guys on the table. Yeah. It's really fun to kind of to put out different situations and kind of see how gangs perform. And I think that Necromunda provides a lot of opportunities for that you don't necessarily get with other games because you're sort of playing with more of a fixed, we're playing this the way it's out of the book kind of strategy or philosophy or what have you.
There's so much creative freedom there, isn't there? No campaigns.
Dixie, did you want to give anyone a shout out?
I think probably just a quick shout out to the other two members of Guilders 4 Radio, Lawrence and Roscoe. We've had to leave them back at the base just in case of Ash Race Nomad raids, so hopefully they're still alive by the time we get back.
Yeah. Well, it one hopes.
If not, we'll head down the trading post and find a couple of replacements.
All right.
I'm hoping to bag more stuff.
Awesome. Well, I'm sure we'll talk again soon, and you guys have a wonderful rest of your evening. I know it's late for you guys.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having us.
And thanks for having us.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that interview. And any questions for ourselves or for Elle, please drop a comment to either podcast. Thanks again for tuning in.
You've been listening to Gilders Ford Radio, broadcasting live all across the Sump, the High, the Outlands, and the far reaches of the Ash Waste.